Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, February 26, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing Octane Fitness and the Highmark cases argued earlier this morning in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that, as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back to our program Professor Gregory Dolan. He is the co-director of the Center for Medicine and Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, where he teaches, among other classes, intellectual property. I mentioned he is a return guest, so thank you very much, Professor, for doing this. He has attended oral argument this morning in both of our cases. He's going to begin the program with opening remarks, describing the cases, describing the oral arguments. And then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for your questions, so please do be ready with your questions. And with that, Professor Dolan, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you again for having me. Thank you for having me back and for the opportunity to attend the oral argument and then share my views with people on this call. So I will begin, I think, as I usually do, by talking a little bit about the cases and how they came up to the Supreme Court, and hopefully that will frame the issue a little bit. And then I will go through the arguments in order that they were made, including concerns that were raised by the justices, and try to tie it in at the end to sort of the overarching themes that the Supreme Court has been wrestling with in patent law over the last few years, as well as perhaps make foolish, but nonetheless I'll try to make at least some prediction as to how, based on the argument, the cases might come out. So let me begin with Octane Fitness. That was the first case of the day. And it presented a question as to when should the courts order fee shifting to happen between the prevailing party and the losing party under Section 285 of the Patent Act. Section 285 allows the courts to order the losing party to pay fees. Reasonable fees to the winning party in a situation where a case is, quote, exceptional. And Octane Fitness case dealt with this question of what does it take for a case to be exceptional. The Federal Circuit has long held that in order to satisfy the standard, in order for the to have the triggering mechanism, because Section 285 says even if the case is exceptional, district court may award fees. It actually is not a requirement. So there's this trigger, and then there's the issue of whether they do or don't. The Federal Circuit has held for quite a while that in order to satisfy the exceptional standard, a two-pronged test must be satisfied. The behavior of the losing party must be both objectively baseless, or frivolous, as the Federal Circuit put it, and it must be subjectively baseless. So in other words, in Federal Circuit's view, the prevailing party on the merits, if they wanted to recover fees, must show that not only was the losing party's position unreasonable, but they knew, or at least had reason to know, that their position was in fact unreasonable. A third, not so much a prong of a test, but the Federal Circuit has held for, again, quite some time, that this showing must be made by clear and convincing evidence. And what happened in Octane Fitness is that after litigation on the merits, the district court actually held that the losing party's position was not objectively baseless, and the matter was appealed to the Federal Circuit. Federal Circuit, again, held to its position that you must satisfy both objective and subjective standard by clear and convincing evidence, and therefore declined to award any fees to the prevailing party. So Supreme Court granted certiorari on this question as to whether or not the test, as announced by the Federal Circuit, whether or not that is the correct test. The petitioners in this case argued that the test is too restrictive, that to limit exceptional cases to only frivolous ones is too narrow of a construction of the statute. Instead, the petitioners proposed that any cases that are, what they said, quote, likely very weak, that was their test, or very weak cases, should be sufficient to qualify under Section 205 for exceptional. Now, again, just because you qualify for exceptional doesn't mean you actually necessarily get fees. It's simply a trigger to allow the district court to give you fees. But the petitioner's view was that cases that are just likely very weak is sufficient. The argument on the petitioner's side descended in somewhat. Justice Kennedy sort of opened the bidding and asked, isn't ultimately the issue here is that we're really wrestling with adjectives? Because ultimately all that we're talking about, whether frivolous or meritless or objectively baseless or any of those situations, is really sort of the type of adjective you choose. And how is one necessarily worse than the other? And the petitioner found was that they were actually never at any point able to pin down the specific adjective that they wanted the court to adopt as a test for exceptionality. At some point, Justice Scalia chimed in, "Well, if we and said that if the only thing that you have to show is that the matter is meritless, isn't any case that's decided on summary judgment meritless? Isn't that the definition that the case is without merit and therefore goes on summary judgment?" And so petitioner spent quite some time trying to narrow its position to while at the same time arguing that the Federal Circuit's test is not is in fact too narrow. The other concern that was raised a number of times through the argument, mostly by Justice Alito but also by Chief Justice Roberts, is this issue of exceptional as compared to what? Justice Alito pointed out that the case is exceptional means so it's an outlier, but there are a number of district judges that see patent cases fairly rarely, and how are they supposed to figure out whether it is or is not, in fact, exceptional before deciding whether or not to award any fees? Again, petitioners didn't have a particularly clear answer to that, but they seem to indicate that it's not should not be necessarily compared to patent cases, but generally to behavior during litigation. Ultimately, what petitioners, I think, settled into is that it's a totality of the evidence test that you should take into account how a patent or how the losing party behaved in the patent office, how they behaved during litigation, how vexatious they were, how baseless or not baseless their claim construction issues were, whether they are patentee or the defendant, and that based on this totality of the evidence, the district court should be able to conclude on its own whether or not the case was or was not exceptional. The petitioners did hold fast to the position that frivolity is in fact too narrow of the standard, that something less than frivolity is required. Their view was that frivolity is the standard for Rule 11 sanctions, and that the two provisions, Rule 11 sanctions, where you could also get fee shifting, and Section 285, are not exactly coextensive. So, you, in the view of the petitioners, you should be able to satisfy Section 285 easier than you could satisfy Rule 11 sanctions. After the petitioners, the United States focused amicus curiae supporting the petitioner, and they proposed essentially a slightly different test. They agreed that the Federal Circuit was in fact too narrow, but they proposed a slightly different test than the petitioners. They suggested that exceptional cases are one fallen into one of the sort of three categories. That cases that are highly unusual, cases that are broad in bad faith, and cases that are objectively unreasonable. But the United States argued that It's a disjunctive test. So it's either unusual, either bad faith, or objectively unreasonable, as opposed to what the Federal Circuit has done, saying that you need both objective unreasonableness and subjective bad faith. And so the United States argued that baselessness and bad faith both are not necessary. They further pointed out that in the views of the United States, it really should be a combination of factors, even if no one factor in the litigation would be sufficient to impose sanctions under Section 285. District court should be able to look at the combination of factors. In a view of the United States, objectively unreasonable is a broader standard than frivolous, and so they wanted the court to adopt that as opposed to the narrower frivolous definition in the Federal Circuit. And the United States also pointed out that in their view, the clear and convincing is the incorrect standard of review. United States was not questioned sort of too much, I think they, in part because I think they were on the podium for shortest period of time. But one issue that came up is that United States put in their brief that what, in their view, sanctions, 285 sanctions are meant for is to prevent gross injustice. And Chief Justice Roberts asked, well, isn't gross injustice really even narrower standard than frivolity? That isn't gross injustice something that's completely outrageous? And Justice Kagan seconded that isn't gross. She asked, like, isn't gross injustice simply another way of saying shocks the conscience, which is even a tighter standard of frivolity? What the United States responded to that is that the gross injustice standard came from Senate reports for the previous Patent Act, the 1946 one, and judicial cases decided between 1946 and 1952. And the argument of the United States was that when Congress enacted the 1952 Act, where it enacted the Section 285 on the exceptional cases, they legislated against the judicial backdrop, and essentially in the view of the United States, what the old courts were saying, gross injustice, actually did include those three categories, the highly unusual cases, the bad faith cases, or objectively unreasonable ones. So in the view of the United States, that if Supreme Court were to look at these old decisions, although the terminology is somewhat different, that they would come out to the same result, that any case that falls into any one of those categories would be sufficient. After that, sir, the respondent approached the podium, and I think the ultimate respondent had somewhat of a tougher time in convincing justice and correctness of their position. The respondent argued that even though it seems that Rule 11 and Section 285 are somewhat duplicative in response actually to a question by Justice Sotomayor. Justice Sotomayor started questioning pretty early and asked, well, why isn't the respondent's position that only frivolous cases are actually subject to 285? Why isn't that position wrong, given that that would simply duplicate Rule 11? The respondent's position is that the 1952 Act preexisted before Rule 11, and that's why even though today they may be coextensive, it's actually not anomalous that they are. Rule 11 and Section 285 came along at different time frames, and it just so happened that, and through different channels, one through the courts, one through the legislature, and it just so happened that now they're mostly are coextensive, but that should not be the court's concern. Justice Breyer ultimately had, I think, the toughest question for the respondent that they were not quite able to answer. Justice Breyer essentially said that he's concerned about situations where the patents are of really, in his view, some of the patents are could be of questionable validity, that it's the chance of winning are low, and yet they're sufficient that it would give the patentee or patent holder an ability to simply to send out demand letters, collect fairly small license fees because of the fear of litigation. And so in his view that in that situation, the claims would not necessarily be baseless completely because, as Justice Breyer suggested, that a smart patent lawyer can always make a decent argument, but nonetheless that patents would be sort of highly questionable and wouldn't shouldn't those be the cases where sanctions are permitted? And again, so like I said, this was the hardest question for the respondent. I don't think they really assuage Justice Breyer's concerns. Another problem for the respondent, in my view, was Justice Ginsburg pointed out that Lanham Act, the one that deals with trademark law, also in fact has a similar provision for fee-shifting exceptional cases. And Lanham Act has been construed not in the same way as the federal court has construed Section 285. And so Justice Ginsburg asked, well, why shouldn't they be construed in prior materia, exceptional under Lanham Act? It's also an IP, again, IP law. Why shouldn't Patent Act and Lanham Act be construed in the same way? And the answer that the respondent gave was because they sort of came at different times and under slightly different standards, which I don't, given my observation of the court's reaction, I don't quite think that answer satisfied the bench. Just take a look at some notes. Finally, in the last few points and the respondents got to address, Justice Sotomayor asked them to talk about the second prong of the Federal Circuit test, about the subjective bad faith and the clear and convincing standard. The respondent answered that he will not defend the second prong of the Federal Circuit test, that as far as his client is concerned, that subjective bad faith is not something that that their case rises and falls on. So it seems that there was no one either on either side of the podium defending the second prong, that it's must not be just objective but subjective bad faith. In part, the respondent said that because the trial court found that his case was not objectively unreasonable. So the respondent said he doesn't really care about the subjective bad faith, and the respondent also said that he is not. He's not going to defend the clear and convincing standard because it's, in his view, is not actually presented in this case, given the district court findings, and said that Supreme Court should, if they really care about this, they should grant a separate cert on this issue, and then sort of crack the joke that hopefully he will not be the one defending it. So again, it seemed that there was no one defending either the clear and convincing standard or the second prong, the subjective prong of the test. So it seems likely that at least in those respects, the Federal Circuit test will be modified. I thought the rebuttal was quite effective. The petitioner got up and said that ultimately the question presented in this case is really how extreme must a case be in order to be exceptional? And in the views of the petitioner, it must not be one that is so highly unusual as to almost never to happen. So the cases need not be extreme or not need not be completely frivolous, but they simply need to be very low likelihood of success. And so this difference between exceptional and extreme, I thought, was quite effective in focusing the court's attention as to where the dispute really lies. On the immediately after this case, the court wrestled with a sort of subsidiary issue in a. Under Section 285. So that was the first case was Octane Fitness. The second one was Highmark. In Highmark, the issue presented was somewhat narrower. The issue was once the district court does in fact assess fee shifting provisions, under what standard should the Federal Circuit review the case? So in Highmark, what happened was that the district court did in fact assess. Found the case to be exceptional and did in fact assess fees against the losing party for a number of violations that the district court perceived. The Federal Circuit on appeal held that this assessment of fees is reviewed de novo because under Federal Circuit's view, the question of what is and what is not exceptional is a pure question of law. The petitioners in that case argued that that is incorrect, it's a question that's underlined by factual findings based on the conduct of each party during litigation, and ultimately it's a question of sanctions that, just like under Rule 11 and other issues, should be reviewed under differential abuse of discretion standard. And once again, the federal government, the United States, was arguing amicus on the side of the petitioner. The the point pressed by the petitioners was that under the Federal Circuit standard, under this de novo review, you have a completely separate side litigation as to whether or not fees should have been imposed. And under previous Supreme Court precedent, Supreme Court has said a number of times that although there's, you know, that Section 285 is not the only provision of case shifting, the Supreme Court has said that fees and sanctions and other issues like that should not, we should do our best as to not to spawn whole new litigation out of attorney discipline and fee shifting provisions. The petitioner cited about 60 years of precedent of pre-Federal Circuit, when patent cases were decided in regional circuits, so from 1952 to about 1984 or 82 when the Federal Circuit was created. All regional circuits used abuse of discretion standards previously, and so did, in fact, the Federal Circuit up until recently. The concern, though, raised by the court was that if all this is subject to abuse of discretion review, given the fact that some district judges don't see the cases that patent cases that often, how will it affect the congressional desire for uniformity in patent law? The petitioners conceded that there would be variation in uniformity because it will be reviewed under a very differential standard, and different district judges may view different facts to be or not to be exceptional. But ultimately, I think the petitioners argue that that's actually a feature, not a bug, given sort of the language of the statute. The United States, again, got up and argued second as amicus. The United States proposed that the standard be what they called unitary, but it still be abuse of discretion standard because it's in the views of the United States supported by text and history of Section 285 and 60 years of precedent. And they pointed out, in fact, that in this case, this was sort of this issue of spawning additional litigation, that the Federal Circuit actually had two separate opinions, one on the merits of underlying patent infringement suit, and the United States pointed out that the Federal Circuit did not even bother issuing an opinion on the merits. This was such a straightforward case. But on the fees, it produced a long and complicated en banc opinion, which in the views of the United States indicates that this was a waste of judicial resources to litigate this ultimately a side issue. Justice Alito pointed out that, well, isn't that always true, that whenever you have a heightened standard review, there's more judicial resources being used, and when you have a lower one, less being used? And the response from the government was that, of course, the Federal Circuit can always review the underlying questions of law. In other words, what should have been the claim construction and whether or not the position of the party given that claim construction was or was not reasonable. But once they settled the legal question, the decision whether or not to impose fees and decision of whether or not the parties behave reasonably given the proper resolution of legal question should be left to discretion of the district court. Don Donner, who is probably the preeminent patent litigator, argued for the respondent, and he tried to make the case that the exceptionality finding is a purely legal question. He tried to parse the statute to say that decision whether or not to actually award fees is discretionary, but whether or not something is exceptional, that trigger, as I talked about in the first case, whether that trigger is or is not present is a purely legal question. Given the tenor of the discussion, I don't think the bench was buying his argument. Justice Sotomayor asked, well, isn't it true that questions such as how did you behave in litigation? Did you provide? Proper experts? How did your expert submit his report? How did you do your claim construction? How did you behave in patent office? Aren't these all factual questions as opposed to legal ones that go into determination of reasonableness? Mr. Donner argued that neither standard is actually ideal. Neither de novo standard nor differential abuse of discretion standard is ideal. Each of them has problems, and he fell back on his argument that, in his view, the real question in this case is which tribunal is in the best position to have a uniform legal rule. And in his view, the Federal Circuit is that tribunal, given the fact that it was created precisely for the purpose of having uniform patent law in the country. Justice Scalia pushed back on this notion, picking up where sort of the United States as amicus left off, and said that that's true if Congress had actually intended there to be uniformity, given, for example, on things like claim construction and other things, which is why they created the Federal Circuit. But they may not have intended to have uniformity on issue of 285. So some judges will be more strict and some will be more lenient, and all will get affirmed because Congress actually did not intend there to be uniformity. And there was no sort of answer to Justice Scalia's concern as far as I could tell. Justice Breyer also pointed out that it perhaps is true that the question of what is and what's not exceptional is a mixed question of fact and law, but one where the facts are kind of very hard to separate from the law and may not, given sort of the complexity, may not be actually worth even attempting to do so. And so perhaps in his view that indicates that this should not be a pure de novo standard review. And again, the respondent suggested that agreed with that proposition, but suggested that ultimately the question is who is the best tribunal to resolve the issues, and again pressed that the Federal Circuit should be one. Finally, Justice Sotomayor, I think, asked sort of the last question of the day from the respondent, and I think, and this will, I'll start talking about how I think the court will come out, where I think the court will actually is going. So Justice Sotomayor posited that you do, in fact, get de novo review on the merits. So on the claim construction or on the obviousness issue or other patent issues, you do, in fact, get de novo review, which, after all, the respondents got here. But on the issue of how reasonably you behaved given that the law, there might be a differential review because reasonableness is not a legal determination but a factual one. The respondents sort of simply suggested that perhaps some of the factual issues that Justice Sotomayor brought up were not part of this case, but as a broader proposition, I think that Justice Sotomayor's question indicated how the bench was thinking. So with that, I think I will give sort of a bit of summary as to and how I think the case will come out. In my view, I think these two cases indicate as sort of an ongoing debate between the Federal Circuit and the Supreme Court about sort of how patent case should proceed as a general proposition. The Federal Circuit seems to prefer there to be fairly hard and fast rules. The Supreme Court tends to dislike those hard and fast rules and tends to prefer sort of slightly more malleable standards. This was, for example, the issue at Bilski, where Supreme Court and the Federal Circuit ultimately came to the same conclusion that the patent in Bilski was not patent-eligible subject matter. But Supreme Court disagreed with the Federal Circuit's fairly restrictive test. And I think this is, again, one of those cases that the same result might obtain. It seems that the Federal Circuit's restrictive test on what makes a case exceptional might fall, especially given, like I said, given the fact that nobody was willing to defend the second prong, the subjective prong of the test, or the clear and convincing standard to satisfy that the prevailing party would have to satisfy. So it seems that the Federal Circuit test might fall. Whether or not that means that any of the cases currently before the court would actually be exceptional is a separate issue. But I think so. The test will now be a bit more loose, and because of that, because I think the Supreme Court will likely make the test more loose and more subject to the totality of the evidence evaluation, I think it also then follows that it will be subject to somewhat a more lenient standard review, where district judges will be able to exercise discretion, but of course with the traditional rule that any legal errors necessarily constitutes an abuse of discretion. One other point that I wanted to, and this will be my last one, is that a particular issue came up in two questions, one from Justice Breyer and one from Justice Sotomayor, that may perhaps foreshadow what might come up next. Justice Breyer and Justice Sotomayor wondered as to what is the proper standard of review on claim construction, given the fact that the claim construction was an issue in Highmark to decide whether or not, given the right claim construction, whether the behavior of the litigants was reasonable. And given the fact that just last week the Federal Circuit, in a 6-4 en banc decision, held that claim construction is a de novo standard, that may foreshadow that the Supreme Court might be interested in that case next, given the questions. And how that will play out, if should they ever take it, may very well be affected by how Highmark plays out. If, for example, the court says in Highmark that claim construction is a legal issue that the court already does de novo, but reasonableness in light of that claim construction is a discretionary issue, that may somewhat foreshadow how the court will deal with this upcoming issue that's likely to land on their docket in the next month or two. So at that, I think I'll stop, and I'm happy to take any questions from the audience.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. In a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for Professor Dolan, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Professor Gregory Dolan, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who rings in, let me make a brief commercial announcement, as I typically do. We might have telephone conference calls scheduled later this week, but as of now, we don't have any at this point in time. Next week, on Tuesday, we'll have a sort of a preview call of the Halliburton case. That's a fraud on the market case. It's going to be argued in the court on Wednesday. And then Wednesday, one of our experts will be attending the Halliburton oral argument and reporting on the actual argument and giving some predictions about the outcome of the case. So don't be confused by that. We have a preview on Tuesday and then a sort of post-argument analysis on Wednesday. But today, of course, we're speaking to Professor Gregory Dolan about today's arguments in the Octane Fitness and the Highmark case. If you have a question for the professor, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are completely open at this point. Let me ask you, Professor, I'm something of a close observer of the court. It seems to me that in the past few years, we've seen 5 or 6 or 7 cases a term, IP cases, after, I don't know, a decade or more of very few IP cases each term. I wonder if you want to talk broadly about maybe the reasons for that that increase, what it says about the court.
Sure. I think, I don't think anybody except the justices knows the true reasons, the true workings of the court. But I think there's a number of theories floating out there, one of which is that the Supreme Court for about 20 years or so let the Federal Circuit be that court of uniformity, let them sort of have a bit more of a free rein to establish those uniform rules of patent law without too close of supervision. But now that the Federal Circuit has done so, has laid the groundwork, the Supreme Court feels a bit more comfortable stepping in without, undermining the Federal Circuit's congressional grant of authority or Federal Circuit's role in the patent field. The other theory is that it's somewhat complementary, but also perhaps somewhat the flip side of that is that because for about 20 years the Supreme Court has taken somewhat of a hands-off approach, the Federal Circuit was not sufficiently closely monitored and has come up with some of the, at least in the views of some commentators, some of the stranger, let's say, or some of the sort of less moored in the statute theories of whether it comes to patent law or, for that matter, a number of other areas in which Federal Circuit has exclusive jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court has taken an opportunity to try to correct course in those situations where the Federal Circuit has strayed from the statutory text and statutory purpose. I think there's some support for both theories, in part because the Federal Circuit has been reversed not just in patent cases but in other cases, and so there's this suggestion that their kind of isolation and their from the debate that other circuits benefit from when they get to see what their sister circuits decide on certain issues. Federal Circuit doesn't have that because they don't have sister circuits that deal with the same issues. That they need, that they as a result they ended up straying a bit farther than other circuits. And I think, and then the third theory, and each of them may very well be valid in part, is that Supreme Court has simply just gotten more comfortable with patent law. It used to be that patent law was in some ways legal backwater. There was not a lot of litigation in patents. Nowadays, it's just not true. I mean, patent cases are multi-million-dollar cases where lots is riding on them. The economy is very IP-dependent. And given the importance, the increased importance of IP to our national economy, the Supreme Court has become more comfortable with taking these cases that are no longer legal backwater. And so they feel that they need to opine on IP cases, much like they need to opine on antitrust or tax or other big economic cases. So I think all of those theories are probably true in part. I don't think any one of them fully explains it, but I would imagine that for the foreseeable future, we will see a bit more active Supreme Court in this area.
Very good. Again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open. At this point, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you have a question for Professor Dolan. Let me follow up on that since we don't have anybody ringing in just yet with a question. Maybe this follows up on your second theory in terms of a course correction for the Federal Circuit. Is there, or I mean, are you following this closely enough to say whether or not there is a single justice or a small number of justices who seem to be in the majority more often than not when there is a course correction by the Supreme Court for the Federal Circuit? That is, do there seem to be some more significant players in terms of moving the Federal Circuit one way or another on the Supreme Court bench?
Oh, that's I think that's a fraught question. Now I have to comment on which justice you are sort of more or less likely to be right. I don't think so. A lot of the Supreme Court opinions have ended up being unanimous. I'm just thinking Bilski was unanimous, at least in the outcome, although the reasoning was actually pretty heavy split, 5-4. Prometheus versus Mayo, another opinion on what is and what is not patent eligible subject matter, was 9-0. Myriad, so the big case last term on whether or not DNA is patentable, was 9-0. A couple of other cases that sort of talked about what is the standard to prove patent invalidity were 9-0. Although it does seem to me that Justice Breyer and Justice Thomas seem to write more often for the court, but given sort of the unanimity of most of the cases, not all, there were some cases that, like I said, Bilski was also unanimous in the outcome, sharply split 5-4 on plus a concurrent opinion on the reasoning. There are a couple of other cases where that had to do with patent law that were also split 5-3, 5-4, depending on who was on the bench. But it seems to me that, and I haven't done the hard count, but it seems to me that Justice Thomas and Justice Breyer tend to get those assignments more often. Now, whether that's because they're interested in this in these matters more than other justices, or because they seem to know or understand patent law better, or for any other reason, I don't know, but sort of that's just kind of my feeling, and I may even be wrong on that, but sort of that's kind of, if I start to recollect who wrote what, I think those two justices seem to get those signs more often, and so that I think should also give listeners a hint that it's not that ideological issue. Justice Breyer and Justice Thomas don't agree on much, but somehow they end up writing a lot of patent cases that ultimately end up being unanimous.
Fair enough. It seems that we still don't have any questions. Let me make a last call for questions. If you have a question for Professor Dolan, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Well, Professor, I guess your opening remarks were comprehensive enough to anticipate any questions. But,
well, either that or completely uncomprehensible, one or the other.
let me nevertheless give you a minute or two to express any final thought you might have by way of wrapping up.
Sure. Well, once again, so thank you for having me, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak and the questions. Like I said, I think this is an ongoing conversation between the Federal Circuit and Supreme Court. It touches on issues not just that were being argued over this morning, but I think it's a broader issue of how the patent law should develop, what kind of rules and how strict those there should be, and how strict those rules should be, or what kind of standards and how loose those standards should be. And I think we'll see more of that this term, and we'll see, I think, more of it next term as well. So I think we're in for exciting times ahead.
Well, Professor, let me, on behalf of the Federalist Society, and let me give you my personal thanks as well for coming down from Baltimore to attend oral argument this morning. Not an easy weather day here by any means, probably not an easy commute for you. We certainly appreciate your time this morning and this afternoon in joining the call. For our audience, a reminder, our schedule is somewhat fluid as always, so I urge you to check the Federal Society's website and our calendar, and also monitor your emails for notices of future telephone conference calls. But until our next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.